What did we do wrong? My father asked, slicing me in half. Nothing, I said. It was a dumb question. How could they have prevented me from climbing those stairs? If anything, it was their support and love that gave me the courage to climb them, to chase weird adventure and come back with stories. You have never done anything wrong, I said to them. You have done everything right. And I was crying now, too, because I knew I had not just fallen down the stairs, but I had fallen away from them in some way, forever, and I knew that it was inevitable and sad, but also right. This all changed when I moved to New York. I did not intend to move there after graduation. I personally wanted to stay in New Haven, Connecticut, and continue to work in the video store, a career with a future. But I was ordered to move to New York by my then-girlfriend, now-wife, who herself had moved there the year before with a mutual friend, and I complied. My first roommate in New York was named Adam, and we chose our apartment based on its proximity to a bar that we liked on 3rd Avenue. The apartment was a duplex. I slept in the living room. Adam slept on a kind of balcony above me that counted as a bedroom. The apartment began below ground. Our one window began at street level and stretched up about 6 feet, perfect for any stranger to stand, arms akimbo, and watch us sleep, or, as would occur, pee on the white bedsheet we nailed up as a curtain. It turns out that New York City had made no arrangements to receive me. No jobs were reserved for recent graduates with a degree in literary theory. No skylit garrets had been set aside in the West Village for me to think thoughts about thoughts about thoughts about books in. Even if New York were paying just a dime a dozen for dumb dreamers like me, the city would go bankrupt in 25 minutes, and that is still true. I got temp work with a book publisher. My job was to tear up 2 copies of David Mamet's Oleana. Fun. And then tape down those pages onto blank sheets of printer paper, and then number those sheets with a rubber stamp, for reasons that are still completely unknown to me. You would think I would have loved it. Aside from the many, many thousands of dollars that I had soaked my parents for indirectly, I had never taken a direct handout from them, because I loved working and having jobs. Aside from my cheese and video mongering, which you know about, I had already washed dishes in a small restaurant in Boston's combat zone. I unloaded trucks for a furniture stockroom. I doled out soup in a pseudo-health food cafe and sold tickets and concessions at the Coolidge Corner Theater, the same Art Deco movie theater I used to go to as a teenager to see Marx Brothers and samurai movies. 2 smells I will never forget are the deep oil and aluminum foil odor that worked into my fingers after a shift at the old ticket machine, and the tang and sizzle of the Windex as it hit the popcorn kettle when we cleaned it. That's how we poisoned people. No one really died. I loved having jobs because it was like travel, a chance to meet different people and inhabit their worlds. So the more tedious and unengaging the work was, the better, because it left more brain space for observation and inquiry, and also, I'm pretty lazy. In college, I had taken a job as a traffic counter. I would sit on street corners in New Haven early in the morning with a clipboard. Alongside one edge of the board was a series of numerical counters. I would count the number of cars that went straight, and then the number of cars that went left and right, and I would write all those numbers down on a sheet of paper. I listened to music on the Walkman I borrowed from my roommate without telling him, and when the batteries wore down, I would turn on the AM radio, and that's how I first heard Rush Limbaugh and began to understand that not everybody absolutely agreed with me about everything. Pedestrians would pass me on their way into work, and because my second shift was at the end of the day, they'd pass me on the way out as well. They thought I had been standing there all day, and I let them think that. Counting traffic was a mystery we could all enjoy. Once a week, I would go to a different cafe or restaurant to meet a woman whose name I forget. I would hand off my count sheets to her, and she would tell me the intersections I was to be stationed at for the next week. One time, I finally asked her, "Why are we counting this traffic?" And she looked at me and she said, "I really have no idea." It was perfect. So you would think that tearing out pages and taping them down and numbering them for mysterious reasons would really be a delight. It was just like counting traffic, except it was inside, so I didn't have to wear 3 pairs of pants to keep from freezing before the sun came up. This is a real step up. But I couldn't enjoy it. As I stamped each page away, a growing sense ate at me that I was no longer becoming something, the perpetual state of college, but ending up as something. And I didn't know what I was ending up as. I had difficulty tolerating that ambiguity, and so I grew anxious and depressed. 309.28. Soon after I tore up those copies of Oleana, I started going to therapy. Someone told me that New York University was offering talk therapy on a pay-what-you-can basis. They charged less because the therapists were all in training. It was like barber school. You show up, they randomly assign you a young therapist, and he or she starts giving your mental health a crude, halting trim. If this does not sound appealing to you, you are wrong. You should always pay full price for a haircut. But if you have a chance to buy discount therapy, you should grab it, because the markup on that shit is insane. Just having permission to talk about yourself, to let your dumb thoughts out of your head so that you can see them as they hang there in silence, is an illuminating gift. You could probably get the same therapeutic effect talking to a cardboard stand-up of Captain Kirk. But in my case, I had a bonus. I had a real human therapist who was also a beautiful woman, only a few years older than me. And you can appreciate what a boon this was to a girl-shy nerd and narcissist. Finally, I could talk about jazz violin all day long, and she was professionally obligated to listen, thoughtfully, and pretend to be interested. I loved therapy, and if my approach to it sounds gross and predatory, that's because it absolutely was. I'm sure she sensed it. But the salutary effect was immediate. My anxiety and depression fell away almost instantly. From then on, my therapy was just a weekly visit with Dr. Woman, my beautiful forest friend. I remember telling her that I was beginning to fall asleep more easily, and I had discovered the secret. The secret was to just fall asleep and not try to control every aspect of my dreams, because my whole life feels like it is spinning out of control. So, for example, if I start dreaming that I am swinging like Batman from a grappling hook, I can just go with that into sleep rather than self-critiquing my own dream as a nerdy cliche. And she nodded and inched her chair backward. This went on happily for a couple of months, and then I received a letter. It was a single-page form from whatever it was called, Psychotherapy Supercuts, requesting some basic address and personal information. Now, I love filling out forms. I enjoy any opportunity to create order out of disorder, while also basking in the impression that someone cares about my address and middle initial, which is K. But there was something on this form that ruined my enjoyment of spelling my own name, a line item labeled diagnosis, and after that a number, filled in by hand, maybe by Dr. Woman herself. And that number was 309.28. I didn't understand this diagnosis. Our therapy had barely begun. I mean, how could she have figured out me, the most complicated person on earth, so quickly? And why was she speaking in numeric code? I brought the letter with me to our next session, and before we even sat down, I totally brandished it. "Hang on," I said. "Before I tell you all of my fascinating feelings, please explain something to me if you can. What is 309.28? She blinked. I was obviously crazy. She explained it was nothing, just a diagnostic code they're required to put down to process payment. She explained to me that the code comes from the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This thick book breaks down every possible mental issue and assigns them numbers, I presume so therapists can gossip about you in front of your face. There was even a copy in our therapy room up on a shelf, thick as a phone book. It was right there. And I asked her to get it down. She said no. She told me that 309.28 was just a formality at this stage, a preliminary diagnosis. There was still a lot for us to work through. There were still many sessions to come, which is, of course, what I wanted. But I couldn't help myself. I had just been told that my therapy had a rule book, and though she protested that it wasn't really relevant to my treatment, and though I knew she was right, I still said, "Get down the book, please." And she relented. It was the fourth edition. It has since been updated, so perhaps this has all changed, but on that day, as I learned after some lengthy and dramatic page leafing, this Dungeon Master's Guide to My Mental Health told me I suffered from 309.28, a.k.a. Adjustment Disorder with Anxiety and Depression. I asked Dr. Woman what adjustment disorder meant. She said it typically follows a change in life status, such as finishing college, or moving to a new city, or both. And then she leveled her eyes on me and closed the book, both on the code and in some ways also on me. "It is often accompanied," she said, "by an inability to tolerate ambiguity." There was a silence as I absorbed this. To be fair, the DSM-4 has its own problems with ambiguity, having micro-categorized all of the enigmas in the mind into an OCD Dewey Decimal System. OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, if you're obsessively wondering, is F42.2. Even solving my humiliatingly simple diagnosis to two digits past the decimal. But she was right. "Wow," I said. "You're a good therapist." And she said, "Would you like to sit down and talk now?" And I did want to. But I had ruined it. I knew if I continued, I would just be a creep, wasting her time. All ambiguity was resolved, and I could tolerate it. "Goodbye," I said. Rocks on top of other rocks. There are no subways in rural western Massachusetts. There are some small commuter buses, but if you're on a bus in rural western Massachusetts, you're probably at the end of some sad story. Mostly, you navigate the landscape with its great green interims of nobody and nothing in your own car, on your own. The streets don't adhere to any comforting city-style grid. They curve and search passage through the countryside. Their names change when you cross the town line, just in case for a brief moment you weren't lost or confused. They lead to strange places. Sometimes Jonathan Colton would bring his family up to visit ours. Jonathan is a musician. He is also my best friend. I hope he does not hear me saying that last part. I would never call him my best friend to his face. I am from Massachusetts. He is from Connecticut. And New Englanders do not say things like that. Yankee ingenuity means the canny, improvised fixes, repairs, and craftwork our predecessors employed to keep their barns and brains intact through long winters without ever having to break down and ask anyone else for help. Shame, embarrassment, and crippling emotional reticence is what this part of our nation was founded on, at least the white part, and Jonathan and I adhere to this legacy. One summer when his family was visiting, my wife and Jonathan's wife, Christine, had taken our children somewhere else for the day, probably to go look at some emus or their eggs, and Jonathan and I had an afternoon to ourselves. "It is very hot," Jonathan said, and that was true. "Is there any place around here to go swimming?" And I told him, yes, there was. A few miles away from our house, in fact, the shallow, bubbling terminus of the North River surrenders to the deep, cold Deerfield River to form a swimming hole that the locals call Sunburn Beach. It has a shoreline of smooth, flat boulders you can sit on with round potholes in them, carved out by centuries of grinding river water and small stones. "This is a great place to swim," I told Jonathan. "You can wade around in the warm, shallow part, or jump off a high overhang into the deep part. I know you can do this because I have seen the locals doing it as I have driven by on the road that is sometimes Route 112 and sometimes Main Street. I drive by, but I never stop. Let's go, said Jonathan, as if you could just do a thing like that. Drive to a semi-legal swimming hole that you have to cross unclear property lines to reach and just swim there among the year-round residents without any sort of invitation at all. I said, I don't know if that's allowed. And Jonathan said, that's ridiculous. I am a good host, so I took him to the river. We drove across the North River Bridge to the little incline where all the locals park, right on the side of the town road, right underneath the town signs that say, no parking. Then we walked across the street to the wooded embankment where every year Franklin County erects a small fence to bar the locals from walking down the well-trod path down to the river, and every year the locals stamp it down. I stepped over this stamped-down fence. The whole experience was nauseating. But I am a good host, and Jonathan, after all, is my pretty good acquaintance. We walked down to the river's edge. The scene there was exactly as I had described it. I'm good at describing stuff. Everyone was swimming and having a good time, and we took off our shirts, gross, and went swimming. And you know what? Swimming is fun. It is easy to forget that swimming is fun, because it first requires the denuding of your disgusting and shameful body, and in this case, walking through a bunch of mud and sticks and riverbank ants before you're there, deep in the middle of the river, weightless, embraced and cloaked in dark water, swimming, cold against the current. We did this for a while, and we had a good time. And then we took a break to walk around the shallow part of the river, and Jonathan tapped me on my shoulder, my bare shoulder, disgusting, and he pointed and he said, what are those? Ah, I said, those are the cairns. If you don't know what a cairn is, I am here to tell you. A cairn, C-A-I-R-N, is a small, artful pile of stones that you see around in nature from time to time. They're a kind of folk art. Often hikers will build them as messages to other hikers yet to come. A little cairn will stand there at a branch in the trail as if to say, go this way for beautiful hiking, or do not go this way because of bear nesting. It's not clear what, really, the cairns are trying to say, and also, bear nesting is not a thing. The cairns are less helpful than they are spooky and quiet and never really on your side. The cairns come every summer to the rivers of rural western Massachusetts. Spindly towers of smooth river stones, carefully balanced one by one, rising out of the shallow bed and a foot or two above the waterline. That's what Jonathan saw now, dozens and dozens of cairns, all standing, mute sentry, in the North River shallows, going back at least a half mile. And that's why he touched my bare shoulder. I explained to him that when it rains, the cairns will wash away. And then a day or two later, they will be back again. Who makes them? Asked Jonathan. Nobody knows, I said. Meaning, at least one person doesn't know, and that person is me. If I had to guess, I would say it's probably the Dumpmen and their people, I said. Or maybe witches? My assessment was reasonable. There definitely are witches about. At the turn of the 20th century, spiritualists and psychics clustered tiny gingerbread cottages around Lake Pleasant in Montague, Massachusetts, for summertime seances and spirit healing. Eventually, factions grew out of a dispute over reincarnation. Followers of George Tabor Thompson, known as the Psychic Songster, believed in reincarnation. The faction that didn't believe in reincarnation ended up dying out, never to come back. Thompson Temple, however, survives, even after a devastating fire destroyed much of the community. In a way, both sides proved their point. Later, the hills were populated by 70s-era back-to-the-landers, and they went into the woods to practice a life in tune with nature, and some went a little too deep, and you stumble across their houses sometimes if you nose down the wrong rutted path. Big old Victorian painted ladies with lawns full of pyramids and gargoyles and god's eyes and mirrored spheres. How many of these people are attempting actual magics, I could not say, but if you're going to take the time to put a crystal ball in your birdbath, you're probably also the kind of person who will stack stones in the river at night, probably while nude. Western Massachusetts, like all of Massachusetts, is perceived as a liberal utopia, good witchin' country. But it is still the country. There's a reason Bernie Sanders opposed new gun regulation, because his Vermont hills, like ours, are home to an equal population of hunters and truck owners and Trump voters. And you see them by the rivers, too, perched midstream on lawn chairs, galvanized buckets of beer chilling in the eddies at their feet, daring you with big smiles to ask them to turn down the country music station on their job site boomboxes. They have a good time. And it would be the height of my own coastal elitism to suggest that there is no way they could be the ones building the cairns. I explained this social landscape to Jonathan, and he agreed that it was very interesting, and that my insight into my neighbors was not condescending or reductive at all. But when he suggested that we, he and I, go and make some cairns ourselves, well, here I took my stand. I said, I don't know what the rules are about that. I told him I was honestly not sure if it was legal for a human being to put a rock on top of another rock around here. And in any case, whoever is making those cairns clearly has a plan in mind, like summoning a river goddess or spelling out MAGA. I didn't want to knock over one cairn and trip a silent cairn alarm and end up in dump jail like my old man. But Jonathan said, that's ridiculous. And so we did it. We went out to the middle of the shallow water, and we cairned. It was a transforming experience. You know how I'm pretty good at everything, usually on the first try? That's documented. Everyone knows. Talk to my old clarinet teacher. Well, in this case, I must confess to you that my first cairns were terrible. I was grabbing rocks from all different geological strata, smashing dark granites in with bone-white quartzes. Amateur hour. Naturally, I went for the big rocks, the showy ones with flashy colors and boss marbling. I hauled them out of the mud as if strength mattered, even for a second in cairn building, and I used these huge rocks as the base for huger, high monuments to overthink, towers that split into two to become double towers and then triple towers. And then I would step back and see how awful they were. My cairns were obvious. They were pretentious. They were rococo. They looked like the tacky resin lawn fountains you used to be able to buy in the garden section of the late and lamented Sky Mall catalog. I miss you, Sky Mall. I'll see you in heaven or hell soon. But Jonathan is a musician, but he is the soul of an engineer, and you could see it in his cairning. He understood it right away, matching like colors with like colors, like shapes with like shapes, into delicate, less-is-more spindles of round, smooth, darkly onyx stones, each a little smaller than the last, and culminating with an almost microscopic pebble. And then he moved on to advance maneuvers. A near-perfectly round offering of granite, about the size of an emu egg, sun-warmed and ancient, perched atop a miniature Stonehenge. He balanced huge stones impossibly on top of small stones. He created arches and buttresses. I swear I saw him float a stone in the air. He was over there making Yes album covers, and here I was with my gaudy Trump towers of rock junk. I never wanted to kick Jonathan, my pretty good friend, in the cairn so bad. But in a moment of rare self-editing, I didn't kick down his cairns. I kicked my own cairns down. I started over. I learned from my mistakes. I sought stones more patiently. I stacked more delicately, letting each stone lead to the next. We did this for hours. We disappeared from each other, and then the afternoon disappeared behind us. Rain came, and we didn't look up. and then it stopped, and the sun warmed our bare backs as we moved from cairn to cairn, adding stone after stone. Oh, I forgot to mention. We were high out of our minds. I'm sorry. That's important context to the story that I left out. So, let me clarify. Earlier in the day, when our wives went out with our children, and Jonathan suggested we go swimming, before that he said, I have marijuana, and I said, yes. So we each took an edible when we reached the river, and now here I was, on the lingering end of a half-legal high, half-clothed, half-submerged in a river equidistant from either shore, reveling in ambiguity, half-literally half-bathed in ambiguity, just a human putting rocks on top of other rocks. And eventually, the sun got golden and low, our edible spell broke, and it was time to go home. We walked up the bank, and this time I did not qualm while I stepped over the fence. I may even have stamped it a little. I can't remember because it was probably a small half-stamp, a respectful stampette. I walked up the road, right on the yellow double line, until we reached my car, which was standing alone and unmolested in its no-parking zone. Everyone else had long gone home. It had been a good afternoon. And I was in the midst of thanking Jonathan for suggesting swimming and setting me on a new life path when I saw it, a Honda Civic crossing the North River Bridge. I am not a car person, but thanks to the year-by-year mug book that is the Wikipedia Honda Civic page, I can testify that it was probably a third-generation hatchback, 1986-ish, and it was making for us fast, with more searing menace than you typically get from a Civic. It was pale blue, with a rusted panel on the front right corner, and tinted windows. There were no markings or bumper stickers that might reveal whether it was the dumpman or the witches, but I felt immediate gut fear. I felt fear when the Civic was driving fast, and I felt more fear when it stopped going fast and started a slow, police-style roll past us, passenger or passengers invisible behind dark windows. Who, I thought, tints the windows of a Civic? But before panic could set in, they passed us. They sped up again, and around the curve, gone forever, and I restarted my breath with a choking laugh. Ambiguity! And I was just explaining to Jonathan that, crazy enough, I was afraid that the Honda Civic was the Cairn police, and I was saying how ridiculous that was, and I had no idea why I felt so paranoid, and Jonathan was agreeing, and that's when the Honda Civic came back. The Civic had gone around the corner, and after one long horror movie beat, it nosed back around again. It headed straight for us, and then it stopped. I looked at Jonathan. Even he was scared now. This was not ridiculous. We were alone on a country road with an idling Honda Civic of unknown intention. Whoever was inside the car began to crank down the windows. That's right. Crank. That's the kind of people we were dealing with. Crank window types. It was neither dumpmen nor witches. It was children. Well, children in contrast to me. There are a great number of colleges and universities just south of where we now stood, and so the region is flooded with young people. You see them in Northampton and Amherst, glowing and gliding around on the belief that their feelings are unique, and that they will never regret their full arm and neck tattoos, because their skin will never age, and their tastes will never change. You sometimes see these young people up here in the hills, and even down by the rivers, lying on the rocks, airing out their loathsome Caucasian dreadlocks, testing out their new theories of public nudity, and here were three of them. A young man, behind the wheel, and two young women, staring out at us. Two older men, who were quickly realizing they were not going to die today. The young man opened and closed his eyes, and he said, "Excuse me, Are you Jonathan Colton and John Hodgman?
Well, I said, the billing is usually John Hodgman with Jonathan Colton.
But the answer is yes.
I knew it, said the young man.
I tried to tell them, he said, meaning the young women, but they didn't know who you were.
I said, that is fairly typical.
Hi, said one of the young women, and then she never spoke again. Jonathan Colton, said the young man. I'm such a fan of all your songs, the story of how you gave up your job as a computer programmer just as you and your wife were having a baby and you followed your passion, recording your own songs about zombies and robots with feelings and putting them on the internet on a pay-what-you-can basis and cultivating a devoted fan base and a new career for yourself as a completely independent artist. It's really inspiring to me.
And John Hodgman, he said, turning to me.
You're still on television. Sometimes.
Thank you, I said.
This dialogue is all accurate, by the way. I remember it perfectly. The young man said, what are you guys doing here? In rural western Massachusetts, in the middle of the road, with your shirts off.
Now, after this afternoon's awakening, I was a little offended. Come on, I said. You know me.
I was just down in the river, getting high and making cairns. That's what my life is all about.
Really? Said the young man. That's cool.
Yes, I said. We are cool. We are in our 40s, and we are really cool.
Okay, said the young man.
The young woman next to him put her hand on his arm. Time to go.
Hang on, I said. I have an idea, and I really did. I took Jonathan aside, and I said, Jonathan, do you still have any of that edible marijuana?
And Jonathan said that he did, and then clearly regretted saying that.
And I said, perfect. Here is my idea. Let's get these kids high.
No, said Jonathan.
No, Jonathan, this is a great idea. They're our biggest fans. It's going to blow their minds to get high with their cool heroes.
No, thank you, said Jonathan.
Yes, thank you. Let's get them high. And then let's get into their car and let them drive us wherever they want to go. And I explained to him that this would be exciting and youthful and unpredictable, just like riding a bus.
This did not end up happening. Jonathan took the car keys away from me. We said goodbye to our new friends, and they seemed happy to leave. I do not know where they went in their lives after that, but I have learned to be comfortable with that ambiguity. Jonathan and I went back to the house. We probably watched a movie or worked on a puzzle. I don't remember. It was nice to be home. That night, Jonathan Colton was taken by witches. He should have listened to me. I miss my friend.
Pills are science. Now, obviously, Jonathan Colton was not actually taken by witches and then replaced with a duplicate Jonathan Colton, a bearded, pop-folky golem made of cursed waxen twine. Jonathan Colton is just fine. That was a joke. But I was not lying about marijuana, and now I feel I owe some explanation to my children who may be listening to this. Children, here is the truth. I like marijuana. Not often, and never when you're around. But I'm a grown-up. I like marijuana pills, and from time to time, I eat them. I appreciate that this conversation is probably awkward for you. I remember when my mom made her own marijuana confession to me, and she didn't have the decency to talk about it in an audiobook so that I could just quickly turn it off and walk away. She cornered me in a hotel room in the mid-afternoon. I was about 21, I suppose, and we were all on a trip to Seattle. There was some professional reason for this trip to Seattle, a nursing conference or something, but that was an excuse. My parents would bribe me with a plane ticket or train ticket, and I would take it because, A, Seattle in the early 90s, amazing, and B, I loved my parents, and C, I was growing up. And we all knew that we would not be taking family trips like this for much longer. And so maybe that is why she seized this moment in the hotel to say, "I tried marijuana a couple of times in college. I didn't like it." I don't recall if I believed this story or not. I was probably concentrating too hard on staring into the middle distance, waiting until it would be acceptable for me to leave this hotel as quickly as possible and go out and drink some beer and listen to some grunge rock music in Seattle. Ugh. There are a few things I dislike more than beer and rock clubs. But you have to understand, children, I was experimenting at that time. It's embarrassing, and I apologize. I also don't recall if I told her the truth when she asked if I had ever tried marijuana. The truth is I had, just once, and not long before that conversation. The first time I had marijuana was in the south end of Boston with Michael and Kenny. Kenny was a projectionist at the Coolidge Corner Theater, where I had worked summers and vacations. He was tall and quiet and wore fedoras and was gay. He had a Doberman Pinscher with a girl's name that I am ashamed to say I have forgotten. Let's call her Alice. The group at the Coolidge was a mix of young people like me and an older crowd, mostly artists, for whom it was a night job. I'd become very close friends with some people at the Coolidge, but Kenny was not one of them. Kenny was shy. Michael, the man who today would be Kenny's husband, often kept Kenny company at the Coolidge and was his bright and loquacious conduit to the world. One day, Kenny showed up with an eye patch. He had gone blind in one eye because, as we all soon learned, he was dying of AIDS. And Alice, meanwhile, was dying of sadness. Kenny got worse and stopped coming to work. Around this time, Michael invited me to lunch at their house on a Saturday afternoon, one of a series of goodbye lunches he was arranging, and even though I didn't know them well, and no part of me wanted to do this, I knew that you cannot say no to such an invitation. And now, children, you know this too. Kenny and Michael lived in three tiny rooms in the South End. I don't remember much of lunch other than the food was good, and Michael was funny, and Alice was sad, and Kenny was quiet and brave, and his eye patch looked amazing. Small comforts. After lunch, we went from one tiny room to another tiny room, and Michael drew the blinds and asked, "Would you be interested in smoking some pot?" Pot being a slang word for marijuana. Honestly, I was not interested. And Michael seemed prepared to accept that answer, even to anticipate it. But then he mentioned that he had the same marijuana source as the Kennedy family. Well, look, I enjoy the finer things in life, and I wasn't going to turn down a chance to be connected to an historic American family, so I smoked it. By this time, I probably had already begun smoking cigarettes. Now, I have asthma, and cigarettes would eventually kill my mother, who could not have been smarter or more unselfish in life, except in this one very specific area. I inherited my mother's dumbness regarding cigarettes for the same dumb reason many dumbs do. It feels good once it stops feeling terrible. And plus, no one is ever going to die, so why not? But I also smoked cigarettes for another reason. They were legal. I am not against drugs. I love drugs. I have taken them all of my life. I have been sucking on a bronchial dilator since I was younger than you, children, along with an increasingly exotic array of inhaled steroids and antihistamines. Once I stole a handful of Vicodins from my friend's dorm room after he broke his leg, and I don't apologize for it, because pills are science. I like pills for the same reason that I prefer liquor to wine. Gin and whiskey are chemistry, carefully formulated and distilled, to create a single, repeatable experiment in intoxication, the same precise flavor and effect across the brand, bottle after bottle, glass after glass. Wine, on the other hand, is like religion. It's mysterious, sometimes literally opaque, and there are too many kinds of it. You never really know if a particular wine is good or bad. You just have to take it, on faith, from some judgy wine priest, an initiate to its mysteries. And wine is also like religion because the people who really get into it tend to be fucking unbearable. But marijuana was even worse. Marijuana was witchcraft, a dank and unpredictable weed pulled from the earth like screaming mandrake roots delivered to your dorm room by some glassy-eyed druid with bad-smelling hair and then ritually burned in a brazier. More important to me, it was illegal everywhere and all the time back then, and children, you know I was a good boy. I didn't even taste alcohol until I was 18, and then only in England, where the drinking age was 18. That's how far I was willing to go to follow the rules. England. But now, with Kenny and Michael and Alice, I smoked marijuana for the first time. We didn't talk much, and what I remember most was the sound of Alice's occasional long dog sighs, and around them that silence, getting warmer and softer. I felt the room fold and unfold around that silence. I was afraid to break it, because I didn't know what would come out of my mouth. And that was how we said goodbye, by not speaking, in a room that contained cruelly three phenomena that would also soon pass on. One, two men unable to marry each other. Two, AIDS is a certain death sentence. And three, grown-ups hiding from their neighbors behind closed blinds as they take quiet, sad communion in each other over their Kennedy grade chronic. So yes, children, if you are offered to share comfort in marijuana with a dying man and the man and dog who love him, I will support that decision in that very specific circumstance. But if you are offered marijuana at a party by a drummer, do not do it. I never meaningfully tried marijuana again until I was 41 years old, and that's when I began experimenting. Two reasons drove this decision. One, my metabolism was changing, and I figured that marijuana is probably less fattening than my nightly martini gallon. And two, as it has been legalized or decriminalized in various states and commonwealths, it has been regulated. The doses are state-measured and chemically predictable. You can go into a shop in Seattle, Washington, and a very nice man or woman with impressive tattoos will describe to you the very specific effects of each microstrain. They will guide you through the world of innovation that legality has fostered. People are making marijuana into strips and tinctures and cookies and sodas and restorative soaking baths and things they call mints, but we all know they are pills. The packaging for these items is well designed, with contemporary typefaces without serifs or a single Grateful Dead dancing bear. And where once you would have been smoking marijuana out of a pipe shaped like a three-eyed wizard skull wearing a top hat, now you vaporize it in any one of a number of beautiful, glowing, imitation iPhones. Once these new weed entrepreneurs essentially put marijuana into an asthma inhaler for me, well, who was I to say no? But before you take this as a complete endorsement, children, please heed these fatherly warnings. First, your brains and bodies are working at peak power right now. Give them time to do their thing. Don't undercut them with marijuana now. Wait until your brains and bodies begin to break down and betray you with knee pain and heel spurs and undefinable sadness. Then you may go for it. Wait, don't go for it. Also, first, make sure that you are not an addictive personality and are otherwise healthy, stable, and part of a functioning emotional support network. And also, that you are an adult who has finished college and or are established in a career that you love. And speaking of careers, while I sort of love the fact that the tattooed, smiling weed pharmacists of Seattle get to work legally and seemingly lucratively in a field they clearly adore, do not become one of these people. And maybe don't try anything until you're 40. Okay, good? Now, then, you can go for marijuana. Oh, whoa, but wait, my 40-year-old children. Before you begin your own experimentation, listen to my chilling true story, which follows. Daddy Pitchfork. A couple of years ago, when I was truly in the prime of my midlife marijuana research, I was invited to speak at a college. It happens from time to time that colleges invite me to stand in a gym or a multi-purpose function room at the campus center and perform my imitation of stand-up comedy for students who are inevitably half-listening while wearing their pajamas. I enjoy doing this. I like sharing my life wisdom with young people. And usually on college campuses, unlike most American cities, you can get food after the show. There's usually one diner or sub shop or food truck that's open very late where I can get an extremely ill-advised steak bomb or scrapple egg and cheese hoagie with hash browns in it that I can eat by myself in a hotel room while watching reruns of Friends dubbed in French if the college is near the Canadian border. That happened once. It was a worldly experience. I was especially excited to speak at this college, though, because my appearance was scheduled for 4/20, April 20th, a marijuana-specific date that I know about. And because college is where marijuana lives, and because Jonathan Colton was nowhere nearby to stop me from making really good decisions about my life, I predicted that those college kids would love me and give me marijuana. I will not reveal the name of this particular college. I will only say that it is a lovely, small liberal arts college in the northern part of the American South. I had been asked to give the school's annual Samuel Clemens address. Now, as you know, I am striving to be more candid and vulnerable in my storytelling. So I feel that I can confess to you that I know very little about Mark Twain. I have never read Huckleberry Finn all the way through. I've never read Tom Sawyer at all. In eighth grade, we read Pudd'nhead Wilson, which is the one about fingerprinting and racial ambiguity. And then I went to an alternative high school and skipped most traditional American lit to read 100 Years of Solitude twice. This is an embarrassing thing for an American humorist with a mustache to admit, but I'm done lying to you. Truly the fullness of my Mark Twain knowledge was that he had a big white mustache and he wore a white suit, and that the actor Hal Holbrook made a career of impersonating him on stage. And here I felt a kinship, as this is the same as my own stage show, except I impersonate myself. I know that Mark Twain's real name was Samuel Clemens, and that Mark Twain was an old steamboating term that a steamboatman would yell after measuring the river's depth. Mark Twain meant the boat had 2 fathoms of water beneath it, which is to say, safe for steaming, I guess. I learned that fact when I was 8, from a toy robot called 2XL that asked you trivia questions. As I say that now, I realize that the many hours I spent alone on the floor of my room answering the trivia questions encoded on the 8-track tape you shoved into 2XL's belly still provide the core of my world knowledge today. 2XL was my Socrates. I explained these deficits in my Mark Twain knowledge to the professor who invited me to give the lecture. To protect his privacy, I will call him Mark Taree, or 3 fathoms of muddy depth, because riverboating is apparently the best source for pseudonyms. He was a Twainologist, and so I felt especially nervous. But Professor Mark was reassuring. He said I had nothing to worry about. His department just had some money set aside for this annual Samuel Clemens address, which Professor Mark used to bring down comedians and writers he enjoys. I wouldn't even have to say anything about Mark Twain at all. Just come down and do some comedy and hang out, Professor Mark said. And once I realized we were both opportunistic frauds, I felt much more comfortable with the arrangement. I liked Professor Mark instantly, even though he liked me. He was about 50 years old, not from the South, but the American Southwest, and he was friendly in a way that a lot of white guys from the South and Southwest can be when meeting other white guys, which is to say, instantly friendly and, to a person from New England, unnervingly so. He was there to greet me at the campus guest house where I was staying. I opened the door and Professor Mark was just there in the foyer, smiling, and he said a big, "Hey, buddy!" And I thought I was going to be murdered. But he didn't murder me. He showed me around. He showed me around the house. He showed me the living room, the screened-in porch overlooking the wandering silvery river. Fathoms unknown, he showed me the 2 bedrooms upstairs, and then we went back down to the little kitchen to show me the array of Panera Bread sandwiches and a bottle of bourbon he had left for me in tribute. It was really nice. I said, "Is this really all for me?" And he said, "Well, I was hoping I could change my clothes here, which is not something you expect or desire to hear from someone you have just met. I said, change your clothes right now? And Professor Mark said, no, no, no. He explained that he lived 40 minutes away. Rather than make the round trip home to change before the Clemens address, he was hoping it would be okay for him to use the spare bedroom upstairs to change into his suit and tie. But don't worry, he said. I won't be in your hair. I'm going to go take a walk and let you rest for a couple of hours, and then I'll take you over to the Clemens address. So go ahead and feel free to shove all the chicken from those Panera Bread sandwiches into your mouth while pacing back and forth in a full-on pre-show calorie panic, and then wonder if I would notice if you drank half that bottle of bourbon before I came back to change clothes and bring you over to the show. He did not say that, of course. There was no way he could know that that was exactly what I was going to do. I did eat all the chicken. I did throw away the bread. I did not drink the whiskey. Instead, I went upstairs to fall into a Panera-induced, deep, dreamless nap, the cotton nubs of the white bedspread digging deep into my cheek. And then I woke up and got dressed in my three-piece corduroy suit, a terrible outfit for even the north of the American South on a muggy spring evening, but it was the closest thing to Mark Twain cosplay I owned. Professor Mark had come back while I slept, which is not as creepy as it sounds. And apparently he was changing into his nice clothes at the same time I was, in the other bedroom down the hall. And when I opened my bedroom door, he opened his bedroom door at the exact same moment, and there we were in our best suits, facing each other across the little landing. I thought it was like the opening of a sitcom, or a heist movie about two guys planning to rob a small liberal arts college, but Professor Mark nailed it. "Look at us," he said. "We look like two brothers going to a wedding." "That is a good line," I said. "I guess that's why you are an expert Twainologist." We walked across campus together, two brothers in their suits in the golden glow of northern southern twilight. It was a beautiful campus, less manicured than most, full of lush lawns rambling down to the river, crossed with slithery paths of tarmac upon which beautiful young people floated by on their strong jogging legs or various iterations of wheels. And they all greeted the professor, and he greeted them one by one, by name. "Hello, Cody. Hello, Paige. Hello, Trip." Those were their names. One by one, he would ask them, "Are you coming to the Samuel Clemens address tonight?" And one by one, they would smile and say, "No." Young people are such natural sociopaths. They could have lied and said, "Yes." Professor Mark would never have noticed their absence when they didn't show up. But why should they bother to lie? Why lie to spare the non-feelings of this faceless older mannequin who makes mouth noises about Mark Twain to them twice a week? They were asked a question, and so they gave an honest answer. No. Cody, in particular, was taken aback by this question and answered it only with a face full of guileless confusion. "What?" his face seemed to say. What did you ask me? "Am I going to the Samuel Clemens address tonight? Well, let me think. Even if I had bothered to remember this thing that you've been talking about in class for weeks, which you have to admit, Professor, is a pretty unreasonable expectation. I mean, even if I did remember what it was, the answer would probably be no. Because, I mean, this is Saturday night. Oh, and may I remind you, Professor, it's also 4:20. So, as far as tonight goes, I hadn't really thought it through, but I think I'll probably smoke marijuana. In fact, now that I say it out loud, I'm going to make it a plan. I'm going to smoke a little marijuana and maybe have a drink and maybe go to a party. Oh, I've heard Paige is having a naked party tonight. That's something we young people do because we all look good naked, and we're also too young to give a shit about our furniture. And after that naked party, I don't know, I'll probably go out and eat three whole pizzas. But rather than going sadly back to my room to watch Friends reruns, I'll go back to the party. And surprisingly, I will be thinner and better looking than when I left because I have the metabolism of a white-hot sun. Then I'll probably have sex with a man or a woman. I mean, we don't really use labels anymore. And after that, sex, I'm not really sure. I might just go back to my dorm room and watch a movie. Yeah, you know, I'll probably just watch a nostalgic movie from my childhood. because even though I am physically mature, inside I'm still very much a child who is terrified by the drunken, high, naked, fornicating adult that I've become. So I'll probably bring out my blankie that I brought from home and still sleep with every night, openly and without shame, because all of my roommates are going through the same thing. And what? What's that? What's that you ask me? What nostalgic movie from my childhood will I choose to watch? I don't know, probably Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, because that came out in 2005, and in that year, I was 11 years old. Oh, I'm sorry, I got distracted. What did you old men ask me again? Will I go to the Samuel Clemens address? Oof. I think you can understand that the answer to that is no. Not ever. Not ever, ever, ever. His students' reactions made Professor Mark embarrassed for me. I mean, I was standing right there. And he would say, no, no, you guys, it's going to be cool. John Hodgman is giving the address. And then Paige or Tripp or Cody would just look at me, a middle-aged man, standing there sweating in my three-piece fake Mark Twain suit. And I would give them a little wave to say, change your mind yet? They did not change their minds. I would get no marijuana from these children. Before the lecture itself, there was to be a reception for the faculty and big donors to the college over in the old State House. Professor Mark told me that it was a perfect reconstruction of the original State House from 1676, erected upon the same site. This was the first I had heard of this old State House party, but I said nothing. Professor Mark wanted to drop his casual clothes in his car first, so we stopped in the old State House parking lot, which I presume was not part of the historical reconstruction. It did not look like a 1676 parking lot, more like a 1989. I'm pretty good at dating parking lots. As he was taking care of his car and wardrobe business, I noticed two men walking up to us. They were two handsome, big, tall white men with big white smiles. One was maybe 55, and the other was in his very early 20s, and I knew immediately that they were father and son, because I had seen this in the American South before, prosperous fathers and sons hanging out together and dressing exactly the same. They were both dressed like dads. White, roll-collar Brooks Brothers button-down shirts, no ties, chinos better than Dockers that still look like Dockers, loafers, blue blazers over their arms. They radiated contentment. The shriveled weirdo in me both recoiled from them and fluttered to their light. Professor Mark emerged from the driver's side of his pale, tan Saturn, specificity is the soul of narrative, and he let out a bright, "Hey, buddies!" He said, John, let me introduce, name forgotten for the rest of my life, and this is his son, name also forgotten. Professor Mark explained that he and the dad had known each other since childhood, that the dad had gone into some kind of lawyering or financing or businessman-type business nearby, and he moved here and had a family, and now they hang out all the time again. I apologies if I don't remember every detail correctly, Professor Mark. I was not really paying attention. But I do remember this. Professor Mark said, he and I are best friends. Now, you know my feelings about those words. What I wanted to say was, what? Are you 12? But because I am mostly only a monster on the inside, and what's more, a professional, a performer who will not only give a Samuel Clemens address for which he is unqualified, but also will press the flesh at an old State House wine mingle that he never agreed to, I only said, nice to meet you. It turned out that dad and son were definitely coming to the Samuel Clemens address. Oh yeah, really looking forward to it, the dad or son said. I can't remember because they were so similar. Then the dad ducked his head and dropped his voice to conspiracy meant to be heard level. Now, Mark, I wanted to say I have a pretty nice bottle of single batch bourbon I picked up on the way. Maybe after the lecture we can all go over to the guest house and have a little party. And Professor Mark said, well, how does that sound to you, John? And I said, well, I am apparently your prisoner, so sure. I only said sure, really. And then the son said, well, that all sounds great, Dad. Also, I have some marijuana. Maybe after the lecture, we can smoke it. He said this in front of three grown men, one of whom was his father. I felt like I should start running away. But his father just smiled and said, 420, right, son? And his son said, you know it, Daddy. There may have been fist bumps. I don't know, because my vision had whited out briefly in shock. Obviously, I had misjudged these two badly. Yes, they were both dressed like dads, but they were both acting like Paige, Tripp, and Cody, and they were working hard at it.